Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from Cubberley Auditorium, brought to you from Cubberley Community Center in Palo Alto. I'm Terry Christensen. I'm chair of the Political Science Department at San Jose State University and a member of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley Advisory Board, and I'm your chair for tonight. I want to welcome all of you joining us on radio as well and invite all of our listeners to join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's panel is the final installment of our three-part series on cyber politics, which we've been pleased to co-sponsor with the Industry Standard magazine. While the first two panels considered online campaigning and the effect of the Internet on democracy, tonight we turn to the technology industry's involvement in the political arena. In typically short Internet time, Silicon Valley and the industry more generally has transformed itself from a political non-entity to a political heavyweight. Both major presidential candidates have made dozens of pilgrimages to the heart of the new economy. They make these trips for votes. They make these trips for cash. But they also want to identify themselves with the technological future represented by the Valley. Silicon Valley leaders have become major political players in their own right, both as advocates for particular candidates and as advocates for certain public policies, often using the ballot initiative as a political tool. Tonight we have a very distinguished panel joining us to talk through these and other issues. Our first panelist is John Doerr. He's the one nearest me. Partner at Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers. One of the most influential venture capitalists in the Valley, John has funded companies like Compaq, Cypress, Sun Microsystems, Netscape, Amazon.com, and maybe even some you haven't heard of. As the co-chair of TechNet, John is the driving force behind the bipartisan group designed to promote the new economy and the political profile of the high-tech industry. He's arguably the most prominent Silicon Valley supporter of Vice President Al Gore. Second panelist is Floyd Kwame. Floyd is chairman of Empower America, a Washington-based issue advocacy organization and a partner with Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers. Before joining KPCB, Floyd was one of the five members that joined National Semiconductor in 1967 and helped build it into a billion-dollar company. With Mr. Doerr, Mr. Kwame is on the executive council of TechNet, but just to demonstrate the bipartisan nature of TechNet, he is perhaps the Valley's most prominent advocate for Governor George W. Bush for president. Our final panelist is Karen Breslau. Karen was recently named San Francisco Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine, for which she was previously White House correspondent. Karen is also a political commentator for Audible.com, and she writes for Wired magazine. She began her reporting career with National Public Radio. And now I'd like to turn the program over to our moderator, James Fallows. Jim is the Washington correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and a columnist for the Industry Standard. He's also a political commentator for Audible.com. He's the former editor of U.S. News and World Report and the author of numerous award-winning books. Jim?
Thank you very much, Terry. Thanks to all of you for coming here this evening, and thanks to our audience for listening in. I have covered politics for a long time, a stretch of years that's distressingly long when I look back on them, but this is a particularly satisfying way for me to look forward to of discussing politics in the way we'll do it this evening, because usually when we cover politics and political contention, we're talking about just the formal shift of power from one party to another. We have the chance tonight to talk about that formal shift of power and some of the deep engines of change in our society and the world's economic base that the people on this panel represent. It's a pleasure for me to be able to be here because I'm here with a colleague whose work I deeply respect in covering this field of the interaction between technology and social life, and two of the people who have made these changes happen over the last decade or two. So you should think of this evening as being something comparable to being able to hear the financiers of the late 19th century get together in New York City and talk about the politics of the emerging of that emerging age, or the industrialists of the early 20th century gathering in Pittsburgh or Chicago or Detroit and talking about how the world was changing around them. We now have the industrialists and financiers and technologists of this era talking about how the changes they are part of, the changes they have helped shape, will interact with the political future we're all we're all thinking about during this election season. I'd like to begin the questioning in a somewhat hostile mode. After all, I am a reporter. And I'll begin this way. So I'd like to ask each of our panelists to reflect on this question. It's not unprecedented to have industries be involved in politics. But when we think about the track record in the past, we usually don't like the way the way this has turned out. The oil industry has been involved in politics, the pharmaceutical industry, the tobacco industry, et cetera, et cetera. Why should we think that this involvement of an industry in politics is going to turn out well? I ask you, John Doerr.
Well, I think the thing to do is to look at the actions, not the words, of the high-tech industry in its brief involvement in policy. And I'm not here tonight to speak for the whole industry, but I can speak to what I've seen them do both nationally and at a state level. And deeply, for reasons of self-interest, they've made their number one priority improving America's public education system. And it's also the most important topic, polls tell us, on the minds of American citizens and voters. And the organization that Floyd and I and others co-founded, TechNet, has made improving education its top priority. But that's not the only thing we've done. We've worked in every way that we can at a level larger than our industry to try to grow this economy faster for everyone in the economy. So you haven't seen the technology industry come together and say, let's lower capital gains tax so our chief executives can be wealthier. You have seen us say, let's go out and fight hard to get permanent normalized trade relations with China, because globalization is proceeding at a very rapid pace, and we need to make sure that all Americans, all American companies, all American workers are part of this new global economy, and we don't try to erect artificial barriers that won't withstand the powerful forces that are represented by free markets and capitalism and all the great virtues that we know bring prosperity largely to a people.
And would you agree with that from a different partisan perspective, that the industry's involvement has been mainly on these issues of larger public interest?
I would say so. I think it is important to realize, though, that the industry really, the technology network really started as a result of the defeat of Prop 211. We had all been sued so many times, so there was a defensive nature to it from a starting point. But once that was behind us, as John has said, we adopted strategies that could be supported in a bipartisan fashion. I still recall an early dinner we had in Washington, D.C., on the Republican side, where I was sitting next to Tom Bliley, and he said something I'll never forget. He said, remember, every 2 years, the American people deal 435 cards. You got to play the whole deck. And I think that's what we've tried to do.
And Karen, in your role as a reporter on this this industry and its emerging political involvement, do you share this benign consensus that so far the industry has not been petty in the interests it's pursued?
Well, it's been both. It has been petty. It certainly in pursuing tort reform, the expansion of the H-1B visa program, making the R&D tax credit permanent. You can argue, yes, there are larger benefits for the economy at large, but yes, of course, it's beneficial to the industry. What I find interesting is, having come from Washington, where you see these just the more naked version of the power struggle, and there is a desire here that I do find refreshing, and I think John and Floyd's altruism is genuine. I don't know that it will last as the technology industry becomes a more established player, and you already see it with members of Congress who see this place as a giant cash register with palm trees. This was certainly not the intention of the technology network. It was formed as a two-way education channel to open to the people in Washington, really to give them an idea of what is going on here, not merely in terms of gadgets and gizmos, but in terms of the transformative power of a lot of this technology to change our politics and to change our society. But the system being what it is, particularly the campaign finance system, it is very hard to you can declare purity, but it's very hard to really establish it and live it. And I do see a cash for favor system emerging here, not because it's the will of anyone here, but because that's the way the system works, and it's pretty hard to change.
And I wonder if to follow on that point, John Doerr, when politicians want to raise money, they think of where the money is. And there are a couple of big places, big obvious places. Hollywood is one big obvious source of money. But the tech industry in general, maybe rivaling Hollywood, is what they think, as politicians think of as an easy target. What has it been like for you to be on one end of that transaction? What has it taught you about politics and the things the industry needs to be cautious about?
Well, I think I remember a conversation that I had with some political leaders who criticized our TechNet network. And by the way, TechNet is not all of technology, but criticized TechNet for being bipartisan and working with leaders of both parties. I won't identify the party, but they said, don't you realize that those folks in the other party are never with you, and we always are. How can you possibly support elected officials in the other party? And I was there with one of my counterparts from good friends, in fact, Jim Barksdale, and he just said, you guys don't get it. We're backing the candidates. We're backing the issues. Policy is what matters the most to us, and we're not naive. We understand that politics is a fundamental way that we Americans have developed the process that allows us to come to decisions that affect the body politic. But I think that the really direct answer to your question is our TechNet organization has pursued change in policy in a bipartisan way. And because of that, we've been effective. And we have been willing to raise money under the current campaign finance laws to back candidates who've taken the time to understand those policies and to be with us. I'd be the first to tell you that I'd like to see fundamental campaign finance reform in this country, and the sooner we get it, the better. But in the meantime, we're going to work with the president we've got, with the Speaker of the House we got, with the and with the system we've got, and do everything we can to improve it.
Would you do you have comparable experiences in this realm?
Well, you know, again, I would comment on what Karen was saying that. Things that are self-serving, there's no question that people go into these things with biases. Biases aren't necessarily bad. It's the way you feel about what's going on around you, and if you want to change something, you got to do something about it. I mean, most of you here come in with certain biases, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Karen mentioned the tort reform, H-1B, R&D, tax credit things. You're right. Those are going to be beneficial to the industry. But also, we believe in the H-1B case, where the assets of a company in the high-tech area is primarily in its people, you either allow them to be here or they form that company someplace else. And so for the strength of the American economy, we think that happens to be a good deal. Yes, it is self-serving, but it's also, we believe, good for the American economy. The tort reform thing. I've been on the wrong end of a number of plaintiff lawyers' lawsuits, and I guarantee you shareholders never got a dime from those lawsuits. The lawyers made a lot of money, but I don't think that helped the American economy. I don't think that helped the American consumer. And as a result, I believe, yes, again, self-serving perhaps, but from the standpoint of building an industry, I don't think it had that kind of impact. So in all of these things, you know, H-1B visa, I mean, if that is so controversial, why did the Senate approve it 96-1? I mean, that's a pretty bipartisan agreement on an issue, and we worked hard to get all 96 votes and are very pleased with that result. So it can go both ways.
And who was the one?
Some gentleman.
Senator Hollingsworth.
Yeah, South Carolina. I knew it was one of the Carolinas. Yeah. I didn't know. I try to wipe those things out of my mind.
I'm going to use the term self-servingness as a segue to the next question, because this is self-serving on my part. I recently have published an article in the New York Review of Books whose hypothesis is one I'll test on you all now here. I'll start with Karen. My hypothesis is that both the conduct of this presidential election and the likely result are exactly what they would have been if the Internet and its allied industries did not exist. The campaigns being conducted primarily through TV, Internet and high-tech-related issues play a tertiary role at best in the campaign. The battle is for the traditional swing votes in the industrial Midwest, et cetera, et cetera. If most of the high-tech industry didn't exist, the campaign would be essentially the same as the one we've seen. Agree or disagree? And what does that teach us about the role of the impact of the industry on politics?
I would have agreed with you until this past weekend. And then I got sucked into the whole vote trading online scene. And I've spent the day going back and forth between the National Archives website, which has the Federalist Papers, in which James Madison explains the purpose of the Electoral College and what it was intended, the kind of wild and crazy sort of proletarian passions it was intended to squash, and these various vote trading sites, which are an expression of, to me, very pure democracy. And I found it fascinating that here you finally, everybody's been complaining about the Electoral College since 1888? I mean, how many amendments? How many failed? So I thought, isn't it amazing? So here you have these sites in the closing days. Yeah, I mean, the Internet was, I thought, a real bust in terms of fulfilling, you know, the prophecies until now. But I thought in the closing days of this campaign, we see almost the Napsterizing of the electoral process, where you see real peer-to-peer networking, you see a political dialogue that has much more passion and conviction than just about anything I've seen offline in this campaign. So I would have been right with you until about 3 days ago.
Well, of course, the story closed 10 days ago, so this was before.
But it's
and would you agree, John Doerr, that the election has essentially proceeded the way it would have if the Internet industry did not exist?
No, I don't think so. I think the Internet's transformed all parts of our lives in ways that are hard to imagine until you realize that just a little over 300 weeks ago, there was no commercial web browser. Just 300 weeks ago. And I think with technology now comprising 40% of the growth in the economy, when, for example, the presidential candidates lay out their plans and where are they going to invest and what are their plans for improving education, what are their plans for keeping their hands off with respect to regulation or Internet tax moratoriums or cyber commerce, there are many points of agreements between George W. Bush and Al Gore, and I'm pleased to see those. But there's a lot of differences that matter also, particularly in the broader economic plans of these two candidates.
And before getting to those differences, what would be your strongest case for this election being different because of the Internet and the allied industries?
Well, I don't think people are totally wasting their time by going up on all these sites. I mean, certainly the George W. Bush site is getting a lot of action. And maybe this is bothering you, Jim, because it's turned everyone into a publisher, and that is somewhat troubling. Yeah, well, that is somewhat troubling to some folks, but people are publishing their view over this medium, and I think it's a very, very important thing to do. So I think it does facilitate the exchange of ideas.
Well, let me push back on that point for a moment. Not from my self-interest as a writer is enhanced by having more stuff on the Internet. There's more places to sell one's work. But what has struck me is in the sort of steering currents of public opinion, you could argue that TV, in particular late-night TV comedy shows, have been more influential this year than anything else, and that it's hard to find a single sort of Internet or new economy source of information that's been as important as old media, if we can call TV that now.
Well, because the Internet is much more grassroots, and grassroots doesn't rise to the level of the Jay Leno show or the David Letterman show. But among the grassroots folks, I'm sure many people in this audience even have expressed opinions over the net, and I certainly have.
4 years ago, we did an exit poll in the Proposition 211 battle, which that was a tort reform campaign in California, but actually affected every business across America. And I'll get to the results of the poll in just a moment. But I think it's important in response to Karen's criticism that was petty or perhaps self-interested.
Parochial.
To say that the industry didn't ask that we stop shareholder lawsuits if management lies. We didn't overreach, which is, I think, one of the really important rules of achieving broad bipartisan compromise. We just said if a company that has shareholders all across the country is going to be sued, the suit ought to be brought in a federal court instead of a particular state court. And that bill sailed through Congress in less than a year because it had broad bipartisan leadership, both sides of the aisle. Now, this poll that we did after we defeated Proposition 211, which was would have been devastating in terms of its impact on corporate governance and responsibility, showed that 20% of the voters went to the website before they voted, and I'm sure those numbers are larger today. So I go anywhere you want to go. The news of the Lewinsky affair, mm-hmm. that broke on the internet. Tell me that didn't affect politics and public opinion in this country. Mm-hmm. It did broadly.
Each of you has been quite restrained in not making the partisan case for your candidate or your party, but let me give you a mild opening to do that now. How do you think historically this result will be seen as mattering? What really matters about this election in terms of the industry and in terms of the nation?
Well, you know, you hear all the time that it doesn't matter much who gets elected, George W. Bush or Al Gore, and I just beg to differ. I think it's an incredibly important decision for the technology industry and the country at large. First of all, you have to look at Gore's record. He has been the chief information architect of this new economy that's been growing, whether it's advocating the fundamental research and development programs that led directly to the invention of the Internet, or that funded the creation of the first web browser, or that caused the research to be done to connect computers together with fiber. People joke a lot about Gore and the Internet, but the truth of the matter is he was speaking with clarity and passion about the power of connected computers. He called it the information superhighway way before anybody else in Washington got it, and in fact, before most people in Silicon Valley got it. So I think the name hardly matters. What counts is that he foresaw that. The second really compelling reason, I believe, to why this election matters is because the economic plans of the two candidates. They're incredibly different. The plan of the candidate who I support advocates continuing the course of paying down the debt, balancing the budget, not advocating a tax break, which would advantage both me and Floyd enormously as relatively wealthy Americans, but having, let's face it, a much smaller tax break that's targeted at the middle class and poor Americans. And I think it even sets aside $300 billion of a surplus as a kind of reserve, the way a family would build up its bank account for unexpected contingencies. The Bush plan doesn't do that. Another point that matters a lot to me is I think Gore deeply understands from experience the globalization that's driving this new economy. So whether you're looking at the threat of loose nukes in Russia or an ascendant China or a very perilous Middle East, believe me, I fear every night that we could have a war in the Middle East and an oil embargo. In my judgment, and this is just my opinion, Al Gore is a far more experienced executive decision maker in dealing with the complex global world scene in which we're going to live. Finally, the next president is going to shape, likely, the majority of the Supreme Court. And on a number of fundamental constitutional issues, from gun control to a woman's right to choose to campaign finance reform, I believe that Al Gore's views better reflect those of a majority of the Americans. So I want to come back to the economy because I think this new economy that we've benefited from in the last 8 years is just remarkable. There's never been anything like it before. Unprecedented levels of low interest rates, low unemployment, high job creation, high wealth creation. And it's because of there was a real partisan vote to raise taxes on the wealthy that balanced the budget. There was certainly congressional cooperation in further reducing the size of government. We've got the smallest government that we've had as a percent of GDP since Kennedy was in office. Gore's pledged he'll continue to keep that government small, and he's got the economic plan and the experience that I think makes him the better candidate.
Did you time that?
I've been keeping count in my head. Let me invite you to answer in terms of what ways this, I mean, obviously making the case for Bush, but what ways this will matter in historical terms?
Well, the big problem is John's just plain wrong on most of the facts. That's the big problem. Let's start with the last point. The percentage of GDP, John, is at the highest level since 1944. I don't know where you get that number.
It's just transfers. So.
Yeah, but that's wrong. You got to look at all the numbers. And, you know, I actually support the governor for almost the same set of reasons with one more reason. My experience, albeit short, because I'm not a long-time person in this political thing, only a couple of years experience, I don't like the partisanship that I see in Washington. I mentioned earlier the H-1B visa thing, 96-1 in the Senate, and it took 4 weeks for the administration to agree to the bill. That is nonsense. If you can't negotiate with Denny Hastert, who is a very, very reasonable guy, a budget, and you still got Congress in session, something is wrong in Washington. I look at the record of Governor Bush on the partisanship side and what he did in Texas in bringing Democrats and Republicans together, and I am moved by that. I think it's an extremely important thing to have happen, and Texas benefited from that. I think Washington will benefit from that. On the economic plan point of view, Al Gore doesn't seem to even think there is a problem with Social Security. There's a major problem with Social Security. An advisory board studied Social Security in the first Clinton administration, and they have done nothing about it. This thing is going broke, and the rates of return, 2% and falling on young folks, I think is wrong. It's wrong to have people paying into a system that has no hope, unless reformed, of ever giving them anything back. It needs reform. And George W. Bush had the courage to pick up that third rail of American politics and do something about it. As far as the tax levels, the fact is that the tax freedom day for the American citizen is now moving well into early May. That's, again, at the latest stage in history. There's no need for that. And it seems to me that government has gotten too large. It's hard to believe that, or at least in any company I've ever become involved with, that you can't control costs better than that. And the problem here, I think, is one of looking for results versus looking at spending levels or processes, the governor likes to say. I like to say spending levels. The Gore camp criticizes the Bush camp in Texas because they didn't spend enough on this, spend enough on that, spend. That's not the issue. It's not what you go spend on. It's what results you get for what you spend. How many people are proud if they spent more for their jacket or coat or dinner than the next person? That's not the issue. Spending is important. And lastly, on globalization, the fact of the matter is the international global marketplace is in much worse shape today than it was when these folks got into office. The IMF ruined the economies of a number of Far Eastern countries. I've personally been in Kuwait. I was in Kuwait 2 years ago with an oil minister, and he was telling me about how that coalition had disappeared that President Bush had put together. Our relations in the Middle East are a disaster. We are not respected in the Middle East. We are considered bullies. We're considered bullies in Latin America. I was told by a senior official in Latin America, and with this point I'll close, although I have about 17 more, by a senior official, that he believes that they broke the Brazilian real so that this administration could protect the consumer price index. Now, that's wrong. I don't agree with that. But the fact that a senior official thinks that is horrible. Go overseas and look at the respect for this administration. You won't find it.
We have 6 more days of the battle for the undecided voter to continue, and you shall bear these arguments in mind. While I begin to, I'm going to look through your questions. I'm going to ask Karen briefly on this point. 10 years from now, what do you think will be seen as having mattered about this election?
I think the Clinton legacy will turn out to have cast a much larger shadow than we can even recognize right now. I think the political mood in this country, the hangover, the impeachment hangover. There's a pall over the political system that is so deep and profound that I don't think we'll be able to really measure it until we have some kind of normalization of electoral and party politics. A decade from now.
We're going to enter now the lightning round of the competition, where we have a lot of excellent questions from the audience. I'll try to get through as many of them as possible and encouraging terse answers from the panelists. Here's one that each of you has alluded to so far. Everyone talks about campaign finance reform. How realistic is it that we'll see reform in our lifetime? Maybe we can assume this from a younger member of the audience. Describe your views of campaign finance reform as it relates to the high-tech industry. What in specific could be done, John Doerr?
So this is a personal opinion. I'm not speaking for TechNet. In fact, TechNet, the whole idea of TechNet is a network doesn't presume to speak for the networkees, for those of you who know how networks work. Which, sadly, is too few of our kids in school, but I can come back to education, I hope. Al Gore has said the first bill that he will sign is a campaign finance reform bill. And what he said he would propose as law, as the first bill from his administration, is the creation of a $7 billion fund, first from private sources. And it would be accumulated over the course of about a decade. And if it can't be funded from private sources, then he'll move to fund it one time from public sources. And by his calculations, that fund will generate enough funding so that we can fund all federal elections between both parties. He is also a strong supporter of McCain-Feingold. George W. Bush is not. If you are interested in campaign finance reform, you should vote for Al Gore. And I think it is the biggest, single, most important thing we can do to reinvigorate our democracy.
What would you do about campaign finance reform?
Well, I think full disclosure is the first thing. I mean, full disclosure is very, very important. And I commend the Bush campaign for putting up all of the contributions to their campaign immediately on the net. You know, the next day from when they receive a check. Because I think you have to know who's backing what immediately. And I would say that that is probably something that both sides could agree on quickly, full disclosure, that shouldn't take a big hassle. I won't get into details in the interest of the question on McCain-Feingold, but I think the problem there is that the new economy is orthogonal to the old economy where you had business and labor. Here you've got companies, competitor A, competitor B, competitor C, and I think giving the organized labor union movement the kind of strength that McCain-Feingold goes for, I think is just old economy. I do believe that there's a way around that with an appropriate bill that I'm sure that the governor would support.
Here's a question that's addressed to Floyd Kwame, but I think John Doerr want to deal with too. It says, Mr. Kwame, assuming the voucher initiative, Proposition 38, fails, what can we do next to improve public education? Please discuss the continuing impact of the ultra-powerful teacher unions and their resistance to change.
Well, this is really a subject where John has shown tremendous leadership. I will commend John for his work on this. We've worked together on the charter school initiative in this state, for example. We need choice in education. We need choice for a lot of reasons. And I think an awful lot of the rhetoric on this subject is really misplaced. What are Americans if they're not great shoppers? And I just don't believe that parents, in shopping for the education of their for their youngsters, would choose a failing school if they had any other alternative. We're good at shopping, and it's made this country great. It's made suppliers responsive. Don Shalvey, who has worked with John extensively and that I know, the superintendent of San Carlos School, tells the story about the fact that when he was the first superintendent in this state to have a charter school in his district. And he said a really wonderful thing happens as a result of parents on that first day of kindergarten having to make a choice. And they get involved in the school system at a happy time. Junior is going to school. They get to know the situation. They make a choice between the charter and the other school rather than depositing their child on the school bus stop only to disappear and then get involved when Johnny does something wrong in school at an unhappy time. I think Don is absolutely right. We're great shoppers. We have the world's greatest university system because it involves choice. We've got to figure out how to get choice into the American K-12 school system one way or the other. Charters are an important step. I frankly believe that vouchers, particularly in those urban schools, are a critically important step.
Floyd, has been very kind with his comments, and I want to tell you Floyd has worked very hard to improve public education in this California, the sixth largest economy in the world, because we were able 2 years ago, yes, in our self-interest, to take all the caps off charter public schools in this state. We were stuck at 120. We now have over 200 charter public schools in California. We're going to add them at the rate of 100 a year. We're well on our way to thousands out of the 8,000 schools. And with just 5 days to go before the election and maybe 15% of our audience being in California, let's remember the most important thing we can do to improve public education in this state is to vote yes on Proposition 39. That's the proposition on the ballot, which addresses the three biggest, most pressing problems in California, that we're desperate for classrooms because we have the most crowded and oldest classrooms in the country, that charter schools don't have access to facilities, and that our school districts are often wasting money the way they spend money for school construction. So Proposition 39 would fix all three of those by making it easier for local communities to pass school bonds, making sure that charter schools then, when bonds, and that takes the threshold from 2/3 to 55%, make sure then, secondly, that charter public schools get access to facilities. They don't today, and Don Shalvey would say the biggest obstacle to these high-performance accountable schools is facilities. And then third, it strictly holds the school districts accountable for how that money is spent and puts a cap on the maximum bonded indebtedness per school issue. So I want to cite one more number for you. By my estimate, the technology industry, the new economy companies, since TechNet was formed, has contributed some $22 million to both political parties. Do you know that the technology industry largely has raised over $30 million for the sole purpose of improving the facilities of the charter public schools in California? The money's talking, and it's being invested in something that'll benefit all the kids in this state, not the parochial interests of the technology industry.
That's a natural connection to the next question, which has to do, again, with the social impact of the concentrations of wealth and talent that the industry has created. And I'll address this to Karen Breslau in the first instance. Silicon Valley is often described as a haven of libertarianism. What do you think about this? Is it good? Is it bad? Does it show limitations of the culture, et cetera? What do you say as an observer and reporter of this scene?
That was actually my premise when I started reporting a piece last year. I went looking for libertarians and didn't find them.
You found both of them?
I found both of them. I think it's kind of gone the way with the mythic entrepreneur
garage
in the garage. The place and the industry have just moved on. This is the center of the communications industry. This is the center of new media, multimedia. Nobody can afford to be a libertarian here. The issues are simply too enormous. I mean, this is the home of what will soon be one of the most regulated industries there is, the telecommunications industry. So libertarianism, I think, is something of a luxury of the past, when this was a hardware software manufacturing place, and people could go complain every few years about unfair trade practices by the Japanese. But the world has changed too much. There is no libertarianism here.
I'd take a different crack at that, because I agree that I think, unfortunately, the word libertarian is misplaced here. The Valley is a meritocracy in so many of his respects. I mean, people here back somebody who they believe will be the right person for that role. I mean, I think the examples in this last cycle are instructive. We had a very, very successful fundraiser for George W. Bush at John Chambers' house. A few days later, he had one for Dianne Feinstein. A little while before that, he had one for Gray Davis. Carol Bartz had a wonderful reception and fundraiser for the governor at her home. 2 days before that, she had had one for Anna Eshoo, who was going to be here. I mean, I think that's instructive of what the Valley is like. We look for individuals who we're going to back, and they do come frequently from both sides of the aisle. Obviously, many more of them are from the – I won't say that.
That's good. Then I won't rebut it.
Well, then we can move on to the next question. Next question involves the intersection of talent of politics and technology in the talent field. Here are the two questions I'll put together. If the Internet is so important to the economy, why aren't we electing a tech CEO as president? And the Business Journal recently ran an article positing which Silicon Valley leaders might serve in either a Bush or Gore White House. Note, John Doerr was named as a possible appointment in the Gore administration. Any informed guesses on this? Additional point, there's certain areas when people decide to go into public life from some industrial base. What's your sense? What will your job be if Gore wins?
The only position I'm running for is partner at Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers. I would like to continue to be able to spend 10 or 15% of my time on working to improve the public education system in a big, broad, bipartisan way. And if President Gore calls for a point of view on an issue, I'd be glad to turn to others smarter than me and offer that to him.
And just to push a little harder on this, there is a tremendous concentration of managerial talent in this part of the country. There's people who have thought about the impact of globalization. Why aren't more of you running for office or serving in administrative positions?
Well, I think there are plenty of Silicon Valley, not just Silicon Valley, technology executives who would make the sacrifice to go into public service. But it's a severe sacrifice. I remember a conversation that I had with Ira Magaziner. You remember he helped architect first the failed health care reform plan and then secondly this administration's hands-off the internet commerce policy. And he ran up personal seven-figure bills to defend himself legally from challenges that came from the other party about how he conducted himself as a public servant. So I think the whole partisan nature of our system, hyper-partisan nature of it, the litigation that's brought against almost any public servant, whether elected or appointed, and the incredible costs of staging a campaign that you have to constantly be raising money, all deter too many good people from being involved in the system. Despite that, I think we'll see more technology executives part of the next administration.
Do you have a declaration for us?
Well, no, I couldn't agree with John more, and that's why we need to address this partisanship problem in Washington and elect George W. Bush.
yeah, get rid of those Democrats and partisanship.
No. Let's face it. The Texas legislature is full of Democrats. And, have you ever seen a situation where 23 mayors in a state backed the guy from the other party for governor? That was pretty amazing, and he's got Democrats out in the hustings right now working for him. I would also say, though, more or less seconding, but taking another view, the technology CEO notion. The political process is more than technology. We are a very, very important thing about what's happening from a new economy point of view, but there's a lot of other things happening, and I think people with a broad perspective are very, very important in this process.
I actually heard an interesting idea from Bill Clinton in an interview. Listen to this. He was talking. This is an interview with Wired that'll be out next week. He talked about the number of technology-driven decisions that have landed on his desk really in the last few years, and he wondered if it wasn't time for a national technology council a la the National Economic Council and the National Security Council, and that's where I could imagine the talent here being used. I think John Doerr is absolutely right. You're going to have a hard time prying people away from their companies to go and be to have their tax returns posted on the internet. But I do think you could find people who would be willing to serve one or two year appointments on a council that would meet at the cabinet level and advise a future president on issues from internet taxation to genetic privacy and some of the really vexing things that are going to land on the next president's desk.
Quickly, here's a question for all of you. How do you perceive each party will promote internet self-regulation as it relates to privacy? Privacy we can predict to be the sort of most controversial internet political issue. How will the parties deal with it? How should they deal with it?
Very carefully. Now, the privacy issue, you're absolutely right, is a complex one because we've tried to deal with this at Empower America, and one of the things that we've tried to compile is a book of all the legislation. And those of you that like a copy, give me a business card, and I'll try to get you one of the 118 bills wending their way through the Congress as we sit here to do various things to Annette and to technology in general. But on the privacy side, you have an interesting problem because Let's just take Amazon.com. I buy all of my books from Amazon, a Kleiner Perkins company, and I think it's a great service. And I kind of like the fact that they make recommendations to me of other books that might be interesting. I look at that as a service. Others look at that as an invasion of their privacy. So when you take the exact same thing and you have this difference of opinion about something as fundamental as that, as easy as that in many respects, you do have a problem defining what the issue is. Now, everybody knows that financial records, medical records are important here, but this is a complex subject, and this opt-in notion is a complex subject also because of this nature of how do you provide service, appropriate service to people. And so, again, it's an area where I think there has to be bipartisan agreement on a step, and I think it's going to have to be a step-by-step type of thing that hopefully we can resolve in that way.
I'd like to make 3 points. The first is that Al Gore has taken the lead in creating a framework, advocating one for privacy protection, and you can find it on his website, www.algore2000.com. But he's called for an electronic bill of rights on privacy that would strictly protect your medical and financial information that can too easily be intercepted and abused by others. He's also called for new legislation to prevent people from profiting from the sale of your Social Security's numbers and protect your privacy there. He has also, at the same time, said he'd like to see the industry step forward and in all other domains pursue approaches that are self-regulatory. And as part of the two-way kind of conversation that TechNet has developed with many of America's political leaders, we've been advised to expect privacy-like regulation from Washington in one form or another in the coming year, and we better get our act together and think about what form we'd like that to take. Contrast Gore's record for a moment with Bush's plan. He has no comprehensive plan for protecting privacy or medical records, no plan for protecting financial information or preventing the sale of your Social Security number. And Texas, as a state, has a horrible record in this regard, but I don't want to go down the partisan path of the details of that.
John, that's categorically not true. Texas has an e-privacy bill as part of their net thing that was voted number one by Brown University of any governmental agency in the country. It has a wonderful privacy thing. The big problem on privacy is the leaks out of the federal government.
As a representative of the rising above partisanship, I'm going to suggest we move to another question, which is, has its partisan overtones, but we'll ask for quick answers from our panelists. If Bush is elected, will Microsoft get an easier ride? Will President Gore pursue antitrust policies more vigorously, and should the Valley worry about that? First, Floyd Crummey.
No, I think the law is the law in that case, and the law will be upheld.
This is in the hands of the judiciary now, the courts.
Case is over.
Okay. Let's see. Here's one. The high-tech industry operates at higher standards of business ethics than politicians, so says the questioner. No tech company could run the ads that political parties are running in terms of distortions of truth. Is there any hope of influencing the ethics of the political system, I assume upwards, instead of just financing it?
Political speech is the most protected speech we have in our country. And, you know, I'll defend forever anybody's right to lie as blatantly as they want in the interest of preserving something that's more cherished, and that's freedom of speech, as long as the lie is about the political process. Now, if it's a management team lying to potential investors about their prospects, that management team ought to be and will be sued. But remember, I think it's very important for us to protect political speech in the interests of our democracy.
Any dissent to that view?
No, the temptation is overwhelming to make a comment. I won't.
Good. Well, yeah, I admire your restraint. But so there's now a question for you. By your restraint, you've earned a question.
Okay, great.
Squamay, in your op-ed piece today in today's Mercury, you spoke out in support of what the questioner calls W's Social Security proposal. Please, we refer to him as Governor Bush. One question has bounced around in my head since Gary Bauer first proposed this idea. What if people invest their money unwisely or not at all? Do you honestly think our political system will have the fortitude to say, tough, you made your choice, now live with it? I don't.
Well, you got to understand that the proposal that the governor has made is exactly what federal, or very similar to what federal employees already enjoy. So this is not something that's totally new to America. I recently was in Chile, and I took the time to actually visit one of those stands where the Chilean citizens can go in and check with their little card how their retirement program is going. And these are essentially mutual funds that are being proposed in these cases. And the bottom line is, as I mentioned in that editorial, there's been no 30-year period in the history of America where the returns have been anywhere near as low as the Social Security program has guaranteed. I believe the problem here is that the current system has to change, and therefore we have to come up with something that, in fact, makes what Silicon Valley has made out of all of its employees, namely a shareholder democracy. That's exactly what our option system allows for, a shareholder democracy. I think it's right. It's worked here in Silicon Valley. Why not allow it across the country?
I suspect John Doerr will point out some of the differences in Social Security.
Clearly, we know there's big differences between Governor Bush and Vice President Al Gore on the question of how to handle Social Security. And he agrees with creating incentives for private savings for the retirement. But he wants to do those in addition to Social Security instead of subtracting from Social Security. He calls it the difference between Bush's Social Security minus plan and his Social Security plus plan. Remember, what the governor is going to do in his privatization program is take about $1 trillion out of Social Security and put it in the hands of individual investors to invest in their retirement accounts. Al Gore has said, let's protect and buttress Social Security so that it's solvent through 2055 by guarding this nation's surplus and paying down the debt, and then offer a tax incentive for additional retirement savings, so much so that a family that saves just $10 a week would have $200,000 tax-free saved by the time that they retire. So I don't know where the $1 trillion is going to come from for George W. Bush's transition plan. That's the real question.
Read today's Wall Street Journal.
Good.
Milton Friedman will answer the question for you.
A quick question for Karen Breslau. Who is more powerful, the National Teachers Union or TechNet? Who is more powerful, John Sweeney or Bill Gates? John Sweeney, the AFL-CIO head. I would say Bill Gates, but what say you?
Ooh. I'm going to say Bill Gates, and that's an excellent question. It really depends, I think, on the outcome of these propositions. Frankly, I mean, one of the things I find fascinating about covering politics in Silicon Valley is that here you have people who are entering politics both at the federal, at the very highest levels, and at the grassroots level in terms of education policy. I would say if TechNet can democratize education policy in California, then TechNet is potentially more powerful than the teachers' union, potentially.
Here is a very brief question I will answer in 15 seconds. You commented on the lawsuits brought against public servants prior to the Clinton-Gore administration. I don't recall this was a major issue. Am I wrong? Yes. During the Reagan and Bush administrations, Bud McFarlane was nearly bankrupted by this kind of thing, Theodore Olson, et cetera, et cetera.
That's okay. Two points for our moderator. I didn't know that.
Here's a sort of pie in the sky. Here's a larger perspective question. To all the panelists, do you believe the continued advancement of communication and access to information will ever have an effect on public political involvement or voter turnout, i.e., will the things you all are creating make for a more involved democracy?
I think so. Yes. In fact, Wired did a survey of the so-called digital citizen, and they found that the more people were online, the more likely they were to vote. Right. And vote regularly, the more likely they were to back candidates and issues, yeah, as opposed to hew with the partisan party line. And just to close the argument so that I don't leave any open holes, more Americans are going online. That means more and more of them are going to be these digital citizens who care about policy.
Last time you were wrong, this time you're right.
Is there any downside you see, Karen, to the effect of technology in involving people in politics?
No. I think actually that's one of my greatest hopes for the Internet is that it creates a forum, and that it also would create alternatives to the current system whereby candidates have to beg for money to buy time from networks. You don't have to beg to buy time to go in cyberspace, and if that becomes an alternative venue for political speech, I think that all the better.
The biggest single ripoff that I believe has occurred in my adult life of the American public has been when the National Association of Broadcasters successfully lobbied with the introduction of new spectrum for HDTV to take away the obligation that Congress and the administration proposed that they offer free airtime, our airtime, to candidates in elections. And they did it very shrewdly. They developed a 30-second spot that they were prepared to run in any district where a congressman was in a close race. And the ad went as follows. Barney Frank is going to take away your free TV, a blatant lie. And they were able to strip from the Telecommunications Reform Act the provision that would have provided free airtime in equal amounts to qualified candidates for federal office. And that was wrong. And it hasn't been very broadly reported in the media. Perhaps NPR, this network, will pick up on the story. But those are our airwaves. This is our democracy. And the chase for money, principally to buy television time for 30-second spots, I believe is corrupting our democracy.
I will agree. That was the biggest political scandal of the last 5 or 6 years, at least. Here's a question about politics in the broadest sense, too. Washington Post reporter David Broder recently wrote a book decrying the initiative system for derailing democracy by allowing a few wealthy individuals to hire firms to collect signatures and get an initiative on the ballot. Is Broder correct? Have initiatives unfairly favored the rich? We only have 2 or 3 minutes to go. There's some initiatives we like, some we don't in the discussion so far. Is the initiative process itself flawed?
I think it's a shame that we have to go the initiative process as much as we have. I think it's provided a way for politicians to go away from their true elected responsibility, and I think it is a problem. One of the ideas I've had is that every initiative ought to at least come before a vote of the legislature, so at least the citizens know how the legislator felt about it, even though it didn't come out of the legislature here in California. I think that would be a good idea, so we at least have something. I was very pleased when we were able to avoid the initiative process with the charter public school bill, and I think it is a shame. I agree with the writer.
I concur with Floyd and would just point out that under the Constitution, at least of California, and I believe many other states, the only way to amend the Constitution of the state is by a vote of the people in an initiative. So I think it's a necessary but too frequently used part of our democratic process. At least in California, there's a wonderful book called Paradise Lost, written by Peter Schrag, and it decries the fact that through initiatives, this state and economy has gotten to the place where a minority can block anything, and our representative democracy doesn't serve us nearly as well as it should. I personally would be an advocate of some pretty wholesale, systemic constitutional reform, but that's a topic for another panel.
You want to add anything, Carrie?
Well, I think
the last word.
Okay,
for you.
Having a fat checkbook does not necessarily mean you have the political savvy to get that to get that initiative through. I think we should ask Tim Draper, who's written about $20 million worth of checks, if he feels the system favors the wealthy.
I want to thank our moderator, James Fallows of the Atlantic Monthly, for tonight leading tonight's discussion. Again, we thank John Doerr, co-chair of TechNet and partner at Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, and Floyd Kwame, chairman of Empower America and also partner at Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, and Karen Breslau, San Francisco bureau chief of Newsweek. Thank you all. And I thank the audience here in Palo Alto as well as those listening on the radio. I'm Terry Christensen. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and the Industry Standard is adjourned.
Great job.